comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to The Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful place we call Earth. Thank you for being here at The Kevin Smith Show. It is talk radio like nowhere else on Earth, and it's the show where you matter. Major media is finally getting around to reporting on this developing story of rather massive but selective animal die-offs. Late to the dance once again, but they're finally getting there. But the spin isn't working. Today, I read an article where it's being speculated that what's happened is fireworks scared these birds in Arkansas, and it confused them. And so then they flew into buildings, and that killed them. Really, give me a break. Have you seen BB Arkansas? Go on the internet, Google BB Arkansas, and then click on images. Take a look at it. Now, this is a town of 5,407 people. There are no buildings there tall enough to have worked in that scenario. Whoever came up with that obviously had not been to BB Arkansas. And what about the single species die-off you see happening to fish 125 miles away in Arkansas? Did they fly into buildings? What about the single species bird deaths near Baton Rouge, Louisiana? Or what about the single species death of 2 million fish in Chesapeake Bay? Same thing, different species of fish in New Zealand. What about the other single species die-offs in Kentucky, in Canada, in California? And today we have reports of some 25,000 dead velvet swimmer crabs in England, washing ashore there in England. Although this one may actually have a reasonable explanation. As I said yesterday, something big is going on. I don't know what it is, not yet, but something big is happening. Remember the callers last month, folks, people that called into the show and told us about strange behavior of insects in their part of the country? Remember that? I wonder if that was a precursor, if that is connected in some way with these single species dying off. In each of these cases, what's happening is people, you know, supposed experts are saying, well, you know, this is nothing really to be alarmed about. These kinds of things happen every now and then, and we think it was this, we think it was that. But nothing that they say makes sense. Nothing they say. Because why? Well, because in Chesapeake Bay, they're saying, oh, well, we think it's a cold water shock. Okay, well, that would have happened to all the fish, you see. And it wasn't just in the United States. It's happening around the world. We'll be back right after this.
Come on.
When Thomas Reed was a boy, he was abducted by beings not from this planet. As the years passed, there were more abductions. And not only of Thomas, but of other family members as well. In time, he learned that his mother had been abducted in her youth, as had his grandmother. Tom's abductions led eventually to professional investigation and documentation of their reality. So my guest tonight is Thomas Reed, and with him, Debbie Cauble, and I think Mike Friedman. Am I correct?
It's Matthew Reed. Mike couldn't make it tonight.
Okay. So Matthew is with you, your brother. Okay. Tom, well, first let me say to each of you, welcome. We're glad to have you here on the show.
Thank you.
Okay, now, Tom, because Debbie has a limited time with us tonight, why don't we just jump right in with that? Give us a thumbnail sketch of the abduction incident to which her investigation is related, and then we'll hear from her.
All right, be quite honest with you, it was regarding my brother Matthew in April, about a year and a half ago. He should probably run with it. Matt, you there?
Yes, I am.
All right. Why don't you take this, since involving the Indiana case?
It was April of 2009, and I had just dropped off a friend of mine. We had gone to the movies, and quite honestly, it was as simple as I dropped him off. I rolled down the window and waved to him, and I drove off. Got to a stop sign, turned left, and an hour and 33 minutes later, I was about 7 miles in the wrong direction next to a field. And I was standing outside of my vehicle and had no idea what happened. I was confused. I wasn't sure where I was. It took me a minute. It wasn't an area that I ever went to on a regular basis. And got back into my vehicle and drove home. I believe it was the next day I called my brother, explained to him what happened. He urged me that I called the Indiana MUFON, and it was 5 days later, two investigators showed up. They took extensive soil samples from my shoes, the vehicle. They used some electronic equipment to test the vehicle, which was apparently showed positive on a Geiger counter, as well as a strange magnetic field on my vehicle, which still permeates to this day. And the investigation was ongoing. I got a little bit more involved with the investigation of my brother in Tennessee. And when one of the investigators wanted to come back out and talk to me, I got to meet Deb. And all I can tell you is the minute she walked through that door, there was an absolute immediate connection with her, and it was just like a weight was lifted off my shoulder, and I just suddenly felt that I wasn't alone. So that is my introduction to meeting Deb.
Okay, Debbie Cauble.
I was a field investigator for MUFON at the time, mm-hmm. And my chief investigator, Stuart Hill, had contacted me about the Reed brothers and Tom's case, as well as what was going on with Matthew in Indiana, and asked me to accompany him this past summer to Matthew's house. He wanted to interview him again and take another look at his vehicle. And I did not go as an investigator. I wasn't an investigator on the case, but I went as an experiencer. In the hopes that I could be of some moral support to Matthew as he wrestled with all of this. I have a long history of family involvement. My family was the central figures in Bud Hopkins' book, Intruders.
Mm-hmm.
And I was Kathy Davis in that book. So Stuart felt that I could be of some help to Matthew, and I'm like, yeah, that's what I was all about. And that's why I started to talk about the things that happened to us, to connect with people like us and help each other. So I went with Stuart to Matthew's house and met him. Immediately when I met him, I knew, I don't know why, but in all the years that I've researched this from the researcher's point of view and talked about it from an experiencer's point of view, I've always found that whenever I meet people that who share some similar experiences to me, I know it right away. Within a couple of minutes of meeting, you know, it's like something you can almost see in their eyes. But I realized that same connection when I met Matthew. And while there, I had brought with me my high-definition video camcorder, and Stuart had brought the compass that he had used in the original visit with Matthew, and I also had my own compass, which was identical to Stuart's. So after we talked for about an hour, we went out and looked at the car, and I did a couple of experiments with the compass, walking around the car slowly. And I also had the videotape on the compass. So as I walked around the car with the compass in my hand, I was videotaping the reaction the compass was having, and it was just spinning. When I went in one direction, it would spin in a clockwise motion, and then when I went back around the other way, it would spin in a counterclockwise motion. And I videotaped that. Then we went to Matthew's backyard, and he told me about another possible strange experience he might have had, and there were some unusual square shape. There was one square shape mark in his yard, and I noticed that the soil and the grass looked somewhat similar to what was left in our backyard years and years ago. So I took some samples for Stuart, and we talked. So I witnessed the reaction of the compass to his vehicle, and I have a similar vehicle to his, so I went over to my vehicle, which was there, and I walked around my vehicle with this compass to see if I could get it to do anything, and it did absolutely nothing. It seemed to only react on Matthew's vehicle, so that was curious.
Was there, he mentioned some electronic equipment that was used to check the car, other than the compass. Was there anything else used?
Not when I was there.
Mm-hmm.
The Geiger counter.
I guess, yes, when he went with Glenn Means the first time, they took that, and that's when they got, when I was there, I think we just had the compasses and my video camcorder. I was mostly focused on Matthew, and mm-hmm. then I was trying to walk steady and, you know, take the videotape. It's not really as easy as it looks.
Yeah.
I do remember Stuart mentioning something about them having a hot spot with this vehicle on one of their pieces of equipment.
All right. Now, when you talk about the needle spinning on the compass, with your involvement as a researcher and as an experiencer, what would you think that would indicate?
Well, something was affecting it magnetically. I asked him if there was anything possibly up in the wheel wells or something, you know, in the car somewhere that could be magnetized that would cause this kind of a reaction, and nothing that he knew of. We looked the car over as best we could, and we couldn't find any reason or anything that would have been magnetic that would have affected the compass like that.
Mm-hmm. So if you walked in one direction, it would spin clockwise. You walk in the other direction, it spins counterclockwise.
Yeah, and it seemed like that the needle moved, the speed of which the needle moved was directly related to the speed which I walked. If I moved faster, it would be harder for me to videotape and walk and hold this to get everything clear. But it was, you know, I was walking around fairly slowly, and the needle was rolling at a steady roll in a relationship to the speed that I walked.
Have you ever seen that sort of thing before?
No, I have not. I've not seen that sort of thing before on a vehicle. I have seen some strange reactions to compasses with the compass in certain areas where we've gone, where there's been reports where people have said that where they've said they've seen a UFO land or something like that, where there was some direct contact with whatever this was. And I've seen compass move around, you know, when we moved into the area and then out. I mean, but personally for me, in 25 years, I think I've seen that one time. And I've heard other researchers talk about it. So it's pretty unusual.
All right. Now, you, at that time, you were affiliated with MUFON. Are you still affiliated with MUFON?
I'm a member, mm-hmm. and I get the journal, but I'm no longer a field investigator. I had too many irons in the fire. So I found out when you try to do too much, you don't do anything very well. So mm-hmm. I backed off a little bit.
All right. So, but back then you were a field investigator, right?
Uh-huh, yeah.
Okay.
But I didn't, I was never on Matthew and Tom's case. Stuart just brought me as more of an experiencer than mm-hmm. an investigator. I just happened to have the high-def camcorder, so I brought it with me.
Okay, now, you have been out to investigate a number of cases. When you got to this case, even though you were not the investigator, you were there, you were seeing and hearing what was going on, and you were conducting at least the experiment with a compass. How does this particular case stack up in your mind with all the other cases that you've been on in terms of, you know, if you rank a UFO incident, you rank it, say, at one, that, let's just say that means maybe, probably not. We get to five and it's pretty sure it happened, but, you know, we don't have real good evidence, but pretty sure it happened. And at a 10, bingo, this is the real deal. Where would this one rank?
Well, I would say, based on my conversations with Matthew and with Tom and with the evidence that Steve White has gathered in his investigation of Tom and what I saw when I was at Matthew's house, and also kind of a little going on my own gut as an experiencer too, I would say that this case would probably be, you know, up around 8 or 9. I'm pretty sure that this is the real deal. I feel a connection with Matthew and also with Tom that, you know, it's kind of a knowing. We in speaking with them and speaking about some of the memories that they've had, we found that, as myself, as an experiencer, Tom and I have described very similar memories mm-hmm. without having known each other or known about each other first. That's one of the reasons I think that Stuart Hill thought that he wanted to bring me, because he knew more about Tom and the case than I was just being introduced to it then. And I think Stuart thought maybe that I, you know, he had seen some similarities. So I feel that this is a pretty good case.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, probably one of the best ones that I've been involved with, even from the sidelines, you know, or seen in a long, long time. And I've been doing in research, investigating for like 25 years.
Now, let me ask you as an experiencer, and I realize, you know, I'm asking you for an opinion, and that's okay. That's fine. But as an experiencer, let me ask you this. Some people will see a UFO or maybe even have contact with the occupants of the UFO, maybe be taken on board. And when it's over, they kind of shrug their shoulders and, yeah, okay, well, it happened. And they move on down the road and move on through life. And other people, it shakes their world up. Why do you think that's the case?
Well, I don't know. Everyone is different, you know. Mm-hmm. And everyone sees things through different eyes. I mean, some people that have these experiences see them as religious, you know, experiences, or see some religious thing to them. I think part of it is how you were raised, you know, what. You know, I've met some people that have had just a sighting, and it's been so traumatic for them and shook them up so badly that they can barely function. And then I've met other people that have had an entire lifetime of weird stuff, and they just seem so centered and strong. I mean, so it's, I think it's just everyone's different.
Mm-hmm. How did it affect you?
From a psychological point of view, you know?
Mm-hmm. How did it affect you?
Well, for a long time, I feel like almost pushed me over the edge when I was young, because I was, you know, 24, and I'm quite a bit older now. But it was a rough year that first year after the main incident, and then we started remembering and talking about all the things that happened in my past and with other family members. But one of the ways that I chose to deal with it is, for anything that I feel afraid of, my way of dealing with it is to face it head on and learn as much about it as I can. That makes me feel like I have more power over it. So as from coming out of these experiences and being terrified to the point of almost not being able to function, I decided that, you know, I got a life to live, and I started to learn everything I could about it, read about it. Got involved with MUFON very early on in Indiana, became the investigator, and, you know, that's how I dealt with it. And I feel like I'm a pretty strong person now because of it, and I feel that I could be of help to, you know, other people, and that's what I would like to do. So.
Have your experiences continued?
You know, it's odd. I have seen things, but it almost seems like as I've gotten older, maybe it's that I'm changing or something, but the experiences are not as physical as they were, with the mark in the yard and the marks on the body and the sicknesses and everything like that. It's more, it seems to have become morphed into something of a more of an intellectual and spiritual nature with me.
Well, Debbie,
I have seen things, you know, April 8th, April 16th, 2008 in Kokomo, Indiana, where I'm from. You know, I began witnessing the orange balls of lights, and then we had the boom, and, you know, got crazy after that.
Well, I know, I'm aware of the fact that you have to limit your time with us tonight. I want to thank you for being with us, Debbie Cobble, and thank you for sharing with us. Folks, we have to step away for a break. We will be back right after this. You're listening to The Kevin Smith Show, and my guests this evening, Thomas Reed and Matthew Reed, and my thanks to Debbie Cobble for coming in and sharing with us her part in this investigation. Matthew, you mentioned that they checked the car with a Geiger counter. What did they find?
Well, it wasn't until... first off, I want to say the investigation was done very professionally, and when they came, they actually interviewed me and went out and did the investigation on the truck without me being present at first. They said, "Do you mind if we go out there and look at your vehicle?" I said, "You know, absolutely." Just prior to that, they asked me, did I have any problems with the vehicle afterwards, and I explained to them that at the time I had two vehicles, and that one particular vehicle is an SUV, and so I didn't drive it as much as I drove my car. But it was the following weekend that I went to go shooting with my son, and when I t- took the vehicle to the shooting area. I went to put it in four-wheel drive and literally got buried. It wouldn't go into four-wheel drive. I was towed out, and I took the vehicle to a dealership. They found out that the four-wheel drive module was burned out. My fuel sending unit was burned out. I didn't realize at the time that the gas gauge wasn't working. I just assumed I had three-quarters of a tank. But the gas gauge wasn't working. The windshield wiper motors were burned out. So when I explained that to them, they said, well, do you mind if we go out and look at your vehicle on our own? And I said, no, absolutely. I'd prefer them just to do their own investigation, not be swayed in any way of, you know, any comments that I would make. I wanted them to conduct their investigation on their own. It wasn't until later that I saw a copy. Actually, I saw it in an email that there was a hot spot on it at the rear of the vehicle only. And then Glenn had explained to me that the compass was spinning. So that's all I know as far as I wasn't there to witness it. They conducted an independent investigation while I stayed in the house.
All right. Now, when you say there was a hot spot, does that mean that that was a spot where there was radiation?
That's my understanding of the terminology hot spot, that, mm-hmm. that it said it got a hit on the Geiger counter.
I actually have a copy of the email that I had forwarded to Matthew. And one of the things here that I want to, if I may, just interject for a moment,
mm-hmm.
Indiana and Tennessee were broken out individually from one another. They were originally combined together as one case, but being that Matthew and I live in different states, mine was conducted by a particular group here, and his was being conducted by the Indiana team. And they came out, and like you said, they investigated it early on, and then they brought in the STAR team, the MUFON STAR team. And then that's kind of when Debbie got involved in it and came out on the second go-around with the compass. And But the compass the first time around was placed on the hood of the car, and it was spinning around very quickly. The email that I got from Steve White, who was now taking the case back over, had communicated with Hill, and Stuart Hill was giving Steve White his findings. And, of course, being that Steve White investigated my case, he was kind of letting me know where the case was now, and that's how I got the information with more detail about what was going on with the vehicle, as Matthew and I kind of knew, but we were not really allowed to talk about it because that part of it was still under investigation, whereas mine was closed. So.
Okay, so the hot spot then does indicate radiation, right?
Absolutely. It was with a Geiger counter.
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously, folks know that in the general public out here, we don't tend to have access to things that are radioactive in a manner that could cause a hot spot like you're talking about. And so, you know, that's pretty stand-up evidence that something very unusual happened. Matthew, did you ever get to the point where you remembered what happened during that missing time?
No, absolutely not. It's one of the areas that, as Tom mentioned, the case has been turned over to the STAR team, and I feel very fortunate with that because I'll be dealing with the same investigators that investigated my brother's case. And I literally just got a phone call about 4 hours ago that they're trying to find a regression hypnosis to see if I can draw back any of those memories. They want to hit three very specific events that happened.
Mm-hmm.
The missing time, I have no recollection of what happened. And the other two events I still have those memories. I just want to get more detail of what occurred on two other events. So to answer your question, no, I don't have any memory of what happened other than I was several miles in the wrong direction on a road I never drove on, next to a giant open field and standing outside of my vehicle.
Now, this happened in 1999, is that right?
No, that was in 2009.
2009, okay.
Yep.
So that was 2009. This is fairly recent. Now, was this your first time to have an encounter with possible aliens?
No, sir. This is the what would now be the fourth time.
Let's go back to how all this began for you two guys. When was the first time one of you knows for sure that he was abducted by beings not of planet Earth?
Well, I'll let Tom explain that one.
that was 1966.
Okay.
1960. You want a quick overview, or you want to?
Yeah. What happened?
The first thing that happened was we had seen some anomalies or orbs, if you will, in our room, in our bedroom. We had a horse farm. My mother raised race horses. We had a 75-acre farm, and the Appalachian Trail ran across the north side of it. So we had a lot of hikers and that sort of thing, and there were a lot of paths and trails. And in the winter, we'd take our snowmobiles up there. We really had a lot of the neighbors and so on. It was a big thing for them to take the snowmobiles down these paths. And in the summer, we'd ride down them with the horses. At that time, I had a Shetland pony and a little smaller horse named Thunder. Just to give you an idea, it was just a very big open area with a lot of paths and trails on it. So with that said, we were in our room one night, and I've tried to explain the feeling that we had or that comes from this certain type of event that may occur. It's kind of, if you've ever gone out on the full moon, you feel like you have that little extra energy. If you take a moon and you triple it, so it's like you have this three moon feeling. Is how I've the best way that I can paint a picture of it. It's not like an anxiety or a nervousness. It's just like this heightened energy that you seem to feel. And in time, you kind of feel that, and then you develop some anxiety because you know the last time you felt that, and you knew it wasn't something you really want to experience again. So you kind of develop your own fear or anxiety
yeah, we understand. Alarm bells go off.
Yeah, absolutely. And so this night was the first night we felt that.
Mm-hmm.
I was in the bottom bunk. My brother was on the top, and we went to bed about the same time, believe it or not, within maybe 20 minutes of each other. I had to walk a mile to the school bus on a dirt road, and he wasn't going to school yet, but because I had to get up so early anyway, they put us to bed around the same time. But we'd talk a lot and stay up, and we had a brook that ran along the back of our house, and we used to keep the window open in the fall. And so this night we're talking, and we had all this feeling came over us that was a little unexplainable at the time, neither of us could sleep. We were a little kind of disturbed by it, I guess, we were looking at the window. I know it kind of bothered me a little bit, just felt very different. And so I reached over, and I off the side of my bed, I had a nightstand, and there was a little white clock there with an analog face on it, and I looked over to see what time it was, and some time had gone by, and it was time we went to bed. And at that point, when I had my head off the side of the bed, I looked up towards the window, and I saw what what I described as, now I describe them as orbs. They're about the size of a small saucer that would go under a coffee mug, and they were about four, maybe five, and I couldn't see them earlier because the top bunk, the way we were sitting kind of covered part of the window, so they may have been there a while and I just didn't see them, but at this point I was able to notice them. And one kind of broke away from the others, and as they hovered kind of right not far from the second pane of the window and went a little bit towards the back wall, it kind of went to the north wall a little bit, about a foot down from the ceiling, and then just kind of wrapped around the south wall and moving very slowly. and I watched it, and it had like a bluish outer ring. It kind of looked like a bubble, and kind of three-dimensional. You know, it did look like a bubble itself, and not like a smeared white mark or something. I mean, it was a very distinguished bubble.
Mm-hmm.
And in the side of it, yeah, I was looking at the inside. This one particular one, which was moving, so I was focusing on that one, looked to have something turning it, like something rolling in the center of it. So I kept looking at it to see, you know, what that might be. And I couldn't help but feel it was like watching me, or it was coming towards me too. It was when it came around near the closet door. It wasn't that far from our bunk beds, and it kind of stopped just before the door to the hallway. And so I looked at it for a while and kind of locked on it, if you will, and then I turned away and I closed my eyes, thinking, okay, this is, you know, even at that age, something was wrong here. I mean, it wasn't like it was horrifying. It was just like a bubble, but it wasn't just a bubble. You know, something was really weird here. And so I closed my eyes a few times and looked away, and it was gone. And that was the first thing that we remember as being affiliated with this. And then about, it could have been a couple of days or maybe a week or two later, again, we had this same feeling again, this three moon feeling that we have. This time we weren't alone in the room. There was a figure in our room that kind of like glowed a little bit, if you will, like a 5-watt bulb. And I remember at that point, and this happened kind of quickly, I remember going into the top of the stairs, and there were a couple of figures there. And the next thing I know, I'm up at the top of a field where we used to ride the horses, so we're pretty familiar with it. And Matthew was there with me, and when we got to the top of the hill, there were more there, and all of them kind of had this little light to them. So, you know, at first, being children, you know, young children, we really thought that the first assumption, if you will, was they were ghosts. You know, that's kind of what it hit me as, and cause you couldn't really make out their faces or the body. I mean, it was just kind of glowed into each other, if you will. And
all right, we have to step away for break. We'll pick up there when we come back. Ladies and gentlemen, don't go away. More with Tom and Matthew Reed right after this. Welcome back to the show. My guests this evening, Thomas and Matthew Reed. And Thomas, you were telling us about this encounter you had with these sort of glowing beings up on a hill outside your home.
Yeah, correct. I think we were at the point where we were at the edge of our property before we went to break. Again, Matthew was there with me. We were at the northeast corner of our property line at...
And now, did they communicate anything with you at that point?
No, that's something that I get asked a lot. The only, throughout all the years it's been happening with my parents and myself and brother and so on, the only way that we've had any form of back and forth, if you will, it's been by... suggestion, maybe planted images. There's been only once on two different visions or pictures, if you will, or images were projected on a wall that I was able to see. But there was no English dialogue or back and forth. It's maybe a slight touch and a suggestion and then an image. And but there is, I will tell you this, there is a calm that comes over you. And it's at certain times. And I can get into that. It's going to happen in a moment here.
Let's move ahead with this story. Now, did you see a craft at that time?
Yeah. So I'm walking down to the side of this tree line, and there was a break in the property that brought you through this onto this path through the trees. And right when I got past that, there was what looked to be like a campsite where these hikers would have had bonfires, and it was kind of broken away. It was a pretty good sized little area, and I remember that distinctively, which is how I found the spot later on. And we went through some heavy brush again, and again it was pretty low, and we had walked under it, and maybe 10 or 15 feet there was another opening towards the right side again. And I was first in line. Everyone was behind me, and then you know the glowing actually stopped once we got into the woods, and they were more like a pewter colored. And my brother was behind me, and I got to the certain point, and I stopped. I saw what, and again I use a lot of metaphors because that's how I remember them when I was younger. But it looked like a pile of dirt. It looked like if you had taken a bulldozer and a big pile of black dirt and just made a big mound, that's kind of what it looked like in the middle of this, like, alfalfa field. And it was fairly dark, but enough that you could see a little bit, and that's what it looked like, a pile of dirt. But I stopped, and I looked behind me, and everyone was there, and I was kind of encouraged some way to keep walking, and I did. And I got within about 20 feet of it, and I could see that there was another being outside of it. Now, if you take a ruler, and I'm coming up at the 6-inch mark of this 12-inch ruler, the being was about at the 10-inch mark, just in from the right, and I was kind of coming onto it in the middle, and I felt this calm I mentioned before. You all of a sudden I felt it was going to be okay. It was, and I started to walk, and the closer I went, the calmer I felt. It was that simple. I mean, the more I walked towards it, the easier it became. And I'd gotten fairly close and looked behind me, and this was kind of odd. But Matthew and the others were gone, and so here I am feeling that I'm kind of out there by myself, and there's this being, and again I took a few more steps forward, and I felt it was going to be okay, and I continued. I don't want to use the word summon, because something compelled me to go, and I didn't feel worried about it. I wasn't that concerned. I don't know why. I just felt it was going to be okay, and then I got within about a couple of feet, and then there I was, and I felt like I stood there forever. But he had raised his right hand and placed it on the center of his own chest, and that's the last thing I remember until I was inside the craft. And Matthew was there. He was about 5 feet in front of me, and he had an escort or a guide, or that's kind of how I refer to him, because they stay with you. And it was to the left of him, and I came in a little wider part of a hallway, which was closer to the... There was not much behind me, but a wall. And then I was escorted around him. I went to the right side of him and kind of walked around him. The hallway was maybe eight feet, maybe 10 feet wide, the widest part. And I walked by him and went down his hallway, which slowly kind of turned to the left a little bit. And then once I got past Matt, it kind of opened up and went more straight down. And got about maybe 15 feet down his hallway, and at the end of the hallway it was darker, and there was a being inside this doorway, if you want to refer to it as a doorway. There wasn't a door there, but it just kind of opened up into this larger area, and there was this taller ET there, the bean, if you will. And I was kind of handed off at that point, and he was, in my opinion, I think he was in charge of everything.
Now, among the things that you sent me was a sketch of the floor plan of inside a ship. Is this the same ship?
Was that the one with the large holding area that I sent you?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, no, that's 69.
Okay.
It's a much smaller disc. This was about 40 feet round, maybe 50 feet round. I should have sent you that as well, but I'll send it to you after. Or if on another break, I can send it to you.
Well, no, you don't need to send it to me during the break. There's no way I can retrieve it and use it while I'm on the air. Okay, so...
All right.
So you had this this experience of being handed off to this other alien. Now, what was their appearance? Did they look like the classic gray that we see in the drawings and so forth?
Well, here's the thing with that, and I've given this a lot of thought. The only one that I saw that did not have, when I used the word headgear, kind of like a... There's something that they're fully dressed or clothed. Their attire is from head to toe. So, be honest with you and your listeners, they could look like anything under there. I don't know. But there was one at about 11 o'clock on the same night. It's the only time I remember without seeing some form of headgear was this particular day. And very pale. The outfits that they were wearing or the attire they had on or... It was more like a pewter color,
mm-hmm.
Like a steel, mm-hmm. and later in 69 it was almost white. So
okay. Now, what about the facial features of the one that did not have headgear?
Well, he was further. He was at the just below the at the base of the screen, and just looked milky white to me. And the eyes weren't that big. Like they were. I remember it was. They were, you know, bigger, maybe closer together, a small chin, and I don't remember seeing any hair.
It looked basically human?
Short. Well, human face, human looking, but not a good looking man, if that's mm-hmm. what you mean. But definitely, a similar structure, yes.
Mm-hmm. So he didn't have the wraparound eyes and the no nose and
no.
Okay.
No, and the other thing, what made me see him or notice him in the first place was that when I was in this, just inside this doorway and fairly early on, the walls going in to the craft, the floor kind of has like this, it's almost like a white, if you can picture, I'm going to use similes because it's the best way to, I find to relay what I'm trying to say, the floor kind of looks like that white plexiglass, and it kind of shined like there was a light underneath it.
Mm-hmm.
The walls put off their own glow. My son asked me if it was similar to a glow stick, and that's about as close of a metaphor I can find for it. And so when I got to the other hallway, or the hallway ended at this entrance area, the room itself that I stepped into, the light from the hallway never seemed to blend or come into that room. It did. The light kind of stopped at the doorway. And this individual that they had handed me off to, turned and stepped back into the hallway a little bit and would go back into the room itself. And underneath this lens, I refer to it as a lens cover, you could actually see with the way the light hit it that there was a biological eye underneath it. And at the time, it looked... kind of yellowish or gold, but I don't know if it's from the tin. But I only saw it a second.
All right, we have to step away for a break. We'll be back, folks, right after this. Thank you. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guests this evening, Thomas Reed and Matthew Reed. These guys are brothers, and they're sharing with us their abduction experiences, having been abducted by beings not from this earth over a period of years, several experiences being abducted. And these have been well investigated, and even a polygraph test involved, and Geiger counter readings, and pretty well documented stuff. Thomas, let's get through 1966, because we're going to have to get through some more stuff before we run out of time.
Yeah, I was thinking about that myself. There's a lot of detail, and I don't want to miss anything. And but I'll move along a little quicker for you. In 1966, I think where we left off, that I could actually see a little bit of an eye, if you will, underneath this lens cover, and I started to look around a little bit more, and I did see this being at about 11 o'clock in front of me. Actually, to describe the ship to you, there was nothing against the walls in this area. It was there were only two tables actually, and there was some type of a something up front. It wasn't actually a table. I don't know what it was, but there was a being to the left of that at about 11 o'clock. He was the only one that looked different. Only had the pale face, the smaller eyes. I don't believe he was wearing any type of headgear. The other two looked identical. You really can't tell them apart. The table that they were standing next to, which was about 4 or 5 feet in front of me, did not seem to have any legs on it. I could see underneath it. I think it was shaped more like an L attached to the far right, as the one to the left of me, I could see underneath it as well. And again, if it was attached to the far left, I wouldn't have seen it really. So I'm assuming that's how they were attached, but definitely they weren't floating or anything. They were attached, but I couldn't see any. I could see, you know, the right underneath it.
What did they do to you?
I'm sorry?
What did they do to you?
Well, this is it. I was standing next to this one, the taller one near the doorway, and he kind of communicated to the individual that was a few feet in front of me at this table, which had Braille on the top. It was more like a bank, but the colors were bronze. It was almost like there's bronze associated with them for some reason in numerous different areas and things that I saw were bronze. He would kind of nod to him in a slow motion. I was looking back to look for my brother. He put his hand to tap my left shoulder briefly. I turned, and he got my attention, and this is where we were talking about the communication, where it was almost, you know, like a it's going to be okay, I want to show you something type of thing. And next thing I know, bang, there's this, the whole front of the craft has a galaxy or of planets or I don't know really what it was, but there was one formation that I remember distinctively reminded me of my Converse sneakers, and it was almost boot-shaped, and it went to the left, and it was the brightest formation of lights, if you will, on that particular image that they showed me, and it reminded me of a sneaker, and I'm not really sure of the significance. I know they were trying to tell me something, but it made me feel important, like this was important, and we were important, and they were trying to get a point across, and this is what I mean. It's not like a back-and-forth verbal type of communication. It's just this touch and feeling and images, mm-hmm. And then after that, they flashed up this other image, and it was a huge willow tree. It was vividly colored. It was gold and green, and it wrapped around the front of the craft, and it was beautiful. At the time, we had a black and white television, so mm-hmm. This was just incredible to me, it's been etched in my mind ever since, and it's what I actually had drawn out, and I'll probably use it for if I do a book. I'll probably use that as a cover for it. It's been that significant, although at the time it didn't seem significant to me. I really didn't see the point in it at all. But now we seem to have this connection with willow trees for some reason.
What was happening with Matthew during all this time?
Well, here's the thing too. Once I was looking for Matt, and he had touched my arm. It kind of took my attention off of him. When I did turn around again later, he wasn't there. They had taken him to a different part of the craft, I guess. We were returned at the same time, but he doesn't really remember after that, what took place. It was kind of, I felt like I was being introduced, or this was an indoctrination of some sort, where they were trying to communicate with me that, you know, we weren't going to be hurt, this wasn't, we weren't in danger, that they were trying to tell us something. And I think, again, it has something to do with our age, that there was a reason that we were young, and they were making this almost a passive tour.
Did you notice any odors that were different from what you were used to?
No. No odors, but it was a little stuffy, and there was a tapping noise, like you might hear on an MRI machine. It was kind of a dun 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 like that every now and then. I do remember that, and that there were really no chairs or nowhere to sit. It was kind of empty inside,
mm-hmm.
Very clean, very sterile, but at the same time, the air might have been a little stale.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, let me ask Matthew a question about this. Now, when all of this began to take place and you guys found yourselves outside, do you remember that happening to you, Matthew?
I do not remember that happening. I just remember my brother and I returning at the same time. My most vivid memories were the 67 abduction. That was activity that I have clear memories of them being inside the house, which Tom can lead into that as well.
All right.
We got to get moving along.
Yeah, we're going to have to move along because I do want to open the phone lines and allow people to participate.
Okay.
I want us to move to the polygraph test. You were examined, Tom, by a licensed polygraph examiner, and I believe it was with reference to this abduction, right?
Absolutely. We sat down for 3 hours with Steve White, and this was an examination, if you will, that took place from an ex-police officer who works in conjunction with the Knoxville Police Department. And it was just someone that we were told was reputable, and he had the latest equipment, and that's where Steve wanted to take me.
And the result of that, people who are watching on our television channel can see it now, the results of that are, according to his report, which is a signed report. Now, folks, what you're seeing on your TV screen there, on the TV channel, you can't see his signature. There just wasn't enough room to get it all on the screen. But take my word for it, the signature is there. He did sign it, the polygraph examiner. And it says, final call, no deception indicated. And that the story that you've just heard from Thomas Reed was the subject of that polygraph examination. And the polygraph examiner says, no deception indicated. Now, there are people that will say, well, you can't use polygraph in court. Well, you can't use a lot of things in court that are good evidence. I mean, there are rules of evidence for court that preclude what 99% of us would say, that's good solid evidence, and the court says, no, you can't use it. A polygraph is not 100%. It may come as a shock to you, neither is DNA. Neither are fingerprints. There are conditions under which fingerprints are questionable. Now, you might be saying to yourself, well, now, wait a minute. That's not true because everybody has different fingerprints. No one has identical fingerprints with somebody else. That's true. But sometimes they're very, very close. And if the print that you pick up, that you lift from a crime scene, is not pristine, if it's a little smudged, sometimes it's not usable as evidence. because it's not identifiable. So polygraph, the fact is, when people say you can't use it in court, that's not true. You can use it in court under certain circumstances, and it's good, solid evidence. No deception indicated. All right, I will move to 1969. If we have time, we'll come back to 67. But I want to move to 1969, and the reason is because you drew a sketch of inside the ship. It looks like it has to be a pretty large ship.
Oh, this 69 was a night and day from the 66 and 67.
Now, Matthew was with you there as well, right?
That was with my mother.
Yes. Yeah, I was there with our mother and grandmother.
So all of you got picked up?
Yes,
indeed.
And Matthew, you have memories of this?
I have vague memories of 69. I remember everything leading up to it. It's like, it seems like every time that I'm on board the ship, I don't have any memory whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
I remember events leading up to. I clearly remember events afterwards, but being on the ship, I do not recall that at this time.
Okay, Thomas, quickly take us through this abduction experience.
Okay, we were at a horse show, and afterwards, my mother had taken us to Upper Cheney Falls, is what it was, for a little picnic, if you will, and we were on our way home. We were in a larger blue Bel Air station wagon, and we were not far from the house, and going down a road that was a two-lane road. It was fairly secluded, railroad tracks to our right. And my brother and I were, he was in the back seat, behind the passenger seat. I was behind the driver. My mother was driving, my grandmother in the front passenger seat. And I had a fireball, and I was going to give it to Matthew, and my grandmother turned around. You could choke on it. Don't give it to him.
All right, for our audience that's not in the USA, let me explain. A fireball, that's the name of a candy that's real popular with kids. It has a very spicy cinnamon flavor, and it makes your mouth feel like it's on fire, and it's red. Now, I've seen these in other countries, but they have different names. So it's a piece of candy. That's what we're talking about. Go ahead.
Yeah, I should have said candy. anyway, she had turned around to the back seat and to make sure I wouldn't give him the candy, and she saw some lights out the back of the car, and I turned because it actually was on the driver's side, and I couldn't believe what I saw. I mean, it looked like a flying strip mall is how big this thing was. It just seemed to go forever, and it almost seemed to pace the car a little bit, but I think it was just so big we kept seeing these lights behind the trees, and it was unbelievable. It was huge, and so Matthew and I were looking at it from the back of the car, and we all saw it. I mean, we were all just in awe about it, and we drove up a little further, and this was one of those typical things where, you know, the car comes to a stop just like you've heard about before, and it happened, and next thing, again, things jump a lot, you know, here we are. I'm in this holding area. It was huge, and it looked like almost like an airplane hangar, and which is the drawing that you have, and I had come in, and I was standing by myself. I was in this hangar, and there was a door behind me, and a door directly in front of me, which was probably, let's say, 30 or 40 feet in front of me. That's how far away it was. And the only thing that I could see in there were some trays and some chrome tables off to my right. And to the left, it was just completely vacant, nothing there. And it was a very big room. And you could have a football game in there. And I was there for, I'm going to guess, maybe 5 or 10 minutes. I was there by myself for a while.
Okay, now this, in your drawing, this holding area is the large rectangular area at the bottom left of the picture, right?
Yes, Kevin.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And then this ET came, I'm going to use the word ET, came through this door in front of me, and did not walk all the way to me. Came in maybe 5 or 10 feet max, and again, I walked to him, and again, here we are with this feeling that it's okay. That changed pretty quickly, but I walked to him, and we went out this door doorway, and I took a right, and we're in this bright hallway, just like the craft that we had in 66 and 67, and didn't go that far, maybe 10 or 15 feet, and took a little bit of a left, and right into this room that was very small, and right as you went into the room, there was a table to the right, and there were, and this is the first time I saw what Matthew saw in 67. This is where I saw this insect, or I'll now refer to it as an insect type being, but it did resemble that. There were two of them to the left, and there was a being to the bottom of this table in front of me, and then I was placed on it. I didn't lay down, I sat, and I just had a weird feeling that last two times that this had happened to us, there was this calm feeling that came over us, but this was just different. This, I just felt very odd. I actually heard some other human voices before I got to this room, and I was very...
Were they speaking English?
The same calm, I was going to be okay type of thing. I was no longer on a field trip. I mean, this was something different.
This was far more aggressive.
Okay, now, you said you heard some human voices. Were they speaking English?
Yes. One of them, I think, was my mother calling my name, but I can't be sure, but that's what I believed it was.
Mm-hmm.
But I heard that actually when I was coming out of the out of the holding area, and I didn't mention that earlier. But it was definitely, and I heard them again. So when I was on this table, I saw these other beings that were, you know, they had the teardrop body, the arms and legs that kind of stem same area of the body, the arms bend in the middle, their legs bend in the middle, they had big bronze, the heads look like an egg, and I got off the table and I just shot for the door. This was not the area that I came in, this was one that was on basically just straight ahead of me, and I came through this door, and there was this huge like intersecting hallway. And had like three hallways that joined it at the same time. There were some gray markings on the floor, and I didn't know where to go. When I came out of it, it was huge. And again, I could hear some voices again. So I stopped, paused for a minute, and next thing I know, I'm being escorted back in the room. Walked straight back to the table. This was no light touch. This was grab your arm strongly, and by my left arm, their right arm grabbed me. And brought me up to the table, and they placed me on the table, and this piece that was in the below the ceiling, if you will, of the room, kind of looked like the top of an MRI machine or a tanning bed, but it had circular holes in it, about the size of a frisbee, maybe an oval frisbee, and they came down and covered me from my feet to maybe the middle of my rib cage. And they had taken these little. This is really odd because I was. I talked to Travis about this in Lexington, and this is one of the few things that
Travis who
he references. So Travis Walton.
Mm-hmm.
And what they had taken these round black. I referred to them about a year or so ago as roundish rocks, black rocks, and they were on like a whitish or milky white, almost like a patch of some sort. And they placed one on my leg and one on my side,
mm-hmm.
and one on my head. And I felt like a couple of bumps in, you know, my head, and there it was. And actually, I was basically out for a while after that. And I used to think that these things were kind of maybe checking my vital signs or something, and this thing was over me to kind of keep me from running. But I think it was just the opposite. I think these little black spheres were some type of it won't seem much different than some type of a Novocaine or something to put me out, and whatever was put over me kind of just scanned my vitals, is what I believe happened. But Travis had the same thing. He mentioned that he had a black sphere and a little milky thing. It went on his face, and next thing he knows, he was out. But his was the size of a golf ball. It was also, 9 years old, so maybe that's why mine were smaller. But it's just something similar that we've talked about,
and
as we try to make sense out of it. And so then I came out of that, the two insect-looking ones kind of... they were going back and forth along from one wall to the next. One kind of stayed there more than the other. One was much bigger than the other. One was only about 5 feet tall. It wasn't much bigger than the other one. And then the same individual that kind of escorted me in escorted me back to the holding area. And we were returned to the station wagon. And when I came to, my grandmother was in the middle of the street. And my mother was in a passenger seat, not the driver's seat, as she was earlier. And Matt was curled up in a fetal position next to me. And so I got out and started calling my grandmother because she was the only one that was awake. But she was kind of in her own world. She was maybe about 15 or 20 feet in front of the car, but she was walking towards this little store that was down the road just a bit. It was the only store in the street. It was almost like a little convenience store. So she was walking towards it, and I was walking to her, and I think she would have stopped and let me catch up to her, but she didn't. She just kept walking, and when she came in the front door, it had one of those bells on it, you came in.
Mm-hmm.
And there were strollers in there and bicycles, and the guy at the counter... when I came in, wasn't by the time I got there, she was only maybe there a couple seconds before me. But she walked over and she put her hands on a stroller, and I was watching from the door and the counter, and she had walked around these strollers and bikes, and she started pushing this one back and forth, and kind of in a just a weird state of mind, and it's like as if there was a baby in it. She just pushed it forward and pulled it back and pushed it forward again, and I used to call her Nana, so I said, Nana, come on, Nana, we gotta go, and I reached my hand out, and she took my hand, and started to tear up, and walked by the guy at the counter again, and she wanted to, stop. She stopped walking, so I assumed she wanted to say something to him, but she didn't, I just pulled her and called her name, and we went outside and went down the steps and back to the car. And when we got about the time we got to the car, my mother was now in the driver's seat, and Matthew was still out of it. He didn't come to till we were just about to leave.
How old were you?
I was nine.
Uh-huh.
Nine, almost ten. This was September of 1969.
Mm-hmm. Matthew, do you have any memories of this whole incident?
I have memories of prior. I remember them looking out the window and seeing something following the car, and the next thing I remember is coming to, and we were just driving down the road, and I was trying to talk to my brother.
All right, we have to step away for a break. We'll be back right after this, folks, so don't go away. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guests this evening, Thomas and Matthew Reed, and they are telling us about their experiences with being abducted by beings not from this planet. Now, Matthew, you were saying that you remember waking up from this abduction experience, and then the break took over, so we didn't get to hear the rest of your experience.
I remember waking up. I was very sensitive to kind of the family's mood, so it was very different. Tom and my grandmother, they were sitting on the passenger side of the vehicle. My grandmother in the passenger side in the front, my brother to the right of me. And they were both just staring out the window. I was trying to get their attention, talk to them. My mother was flying down the road. Now, my mom had a tendency to have a lead foot. I give that granted, but normally with my grandmother, she'd be telling her to slow down.
Mm-hmm.
No one was talking. She was flying down the road. And at that time, I was born with a club foot. So I had a foot gear on my right foot that was very similar to what most people have seen in Forrest Gump. And that shoe and brace was off my leg. And why, I don't know. But that's the memory that I have. And I remember picking it up and just kind of holding on to it. And I just stopped saying anything. And my mom just, she was flying down the road.
All right. Now, did your mom or your grandmother, either one, ever tell you what they experienced on that ship?
My grandmother has never, she acknowledged that things happened. Quick history, my grandmother was very religious. I think that this really tested her faith for whatever reason. So she didn't speak to us openly about it. My mom had been very forthcoming. There was a lot of things when we were younger, she would give tidbits, and she acknowledged these things. But it wasn't until, my brother diligently has been pursuing this his entire life, on his own, and as he presented evidence, yes, she started coming forth with memories and sharing her experiences with us.
What happened to her on that ship?
She, my mother really, she remembers being, she remembers more like Matthew does, more than anything. She remembers the vehicle and that something had happened. She writes, she sends me letters, emails and stuff, and she's got, we have a binder that we keep a lot of our correspondence in, her position on this is that she remembers little snapshots of things. She remembers like a 3-second glimpse of this room, and she remembers a couple of seconds of this, but 1954, when she had her first abduction and with her friend Kip was there, she remembers that vividly, and in 67, she remembers 67 vividly. That's why I really think it's important that Matthew talks about that a little bit, because she was involved in that. We all were in a different point of this entire night. We all remembered everything very well, but this particular night, she remembers just bits and pieces of it.
All right, let's do 67, but we're going to have to do it in about 5 minutes.
All right, Matt.
I can do it in about 5 minutes. 67 was another similar evening. We were all downstairs. I was in my onesie pajamas eating animal crackers, and finally my mom and grandmother said, you need to go to bed. We went to bed. It was getting dusk. It was starting to get dark. It was a cool breeze coming into the window. But the key points of this evening was seeing these ginormous flashes of light. And I was very scared of thunderstorms, and with the window being open, so there was an eerie feel to it, a lot of energy in the air. But thunder never came. The flashes were just brilliant and almost right. Glowed through the walls. Tom and I were having a conversation.
Sorry.
And he was talking, I was talking, I told him I was kind of nervous, I was scared. And in an instant, there was a small attic hatchway at the base of our bed. That started rattling, the closet door started rattling, and I thought in my mind that Tom was kicking the door and making this noise, and I leaned down to say something to him, and he was gone. He didn't leave the room. We had it was an old farmhouse, so I had that, you move a latch, then you lift it to open up the door. Your UK listeners will understand those kind of doors. I would have heard him go out the door, or if he left, I would have followed them out of there. But he was gone. I jumped out of the bed. I started wrestling with the door. I had the sensation that there was something in the room with me. I finally got the door open. I shot down the hall and into my mom's room. And at the time, my mother and grandmother were sharing a bedroom. We had a sick aunt from New York City that was staying with us. And she was sleeping in my grandmother's bedroom. So I darted into the room and went straight to the back of the room, which was where my mother's bed was. I dove over the bed, and I was trying to wake her up. She was absolutely wasn't coming to. She was out cold. I leaned over, and I had my chin on the small of her back, and I saw two ETs enter the room. They were tall, not ginormous, but they were taller than some other beings that I've seen in the past. Two of them walked in and came around to the south side of my grandmother's bed, and we kind of was just standing there. Immediately, two more beings came in to the room and were to the other side of the bed. And as Tom described, we only see these infrequently, is this shorter, and the best way to describe it was reptilian in its motion. He was jointed different than the other ones that were in the room. They came in and got to the foot of my grandmother's bed, took a step up onto the bed, started shaking my mother again, and at this age, and since, you know, aliens and ETs weren't commonplace, I thought these were ghosts, but this one being was the scariest ghost I've ever seen or would perceive of seeing. He gets up on the bed, and he's kind of looking down at her. Now, its head was very independent from a human. It had a very small stem neck, but it moved almost robotically. And as every time I shook my mom, it would just kind of turn. And I was afraid that it saw me. So I'd stop trying to wake her for a moment. It would turn back, look at my grandmother. And at this point, I just had to wake her up. I pushed my back up against the wall, pushed my feet on her lower half of her body, and was literally trying to shove her off the bed. This one reptilian type being took a step backwards off the bed, rotated around and looked at me dead in the eyes, and I'm staring at him, and it was probably only for a second, but it seemed like forever. And as I finally slid my mom off the bed, they left the room. The last two that came in exited the room. The other ones started to exit, walked past this one reptilian type creature, and then it took a step, maybe a step and a half again near me. She slides off the bed, and he kind of scans the room and walks out. She lands on the floor. She gets up. She goes, "What's going on?" I said, "There's people in the house. Tom's gone," and she just kind of panics. She runs out the door, and as she's getting her robe on to run out the door, I could see just the heads of them going down the stairways. Now, from this vantage point of where I'm in her bedroom, if I look out her door, I could see the top of the stairway, and then it curves to the right and goes down to the bottom floor. I could still kind of see their glowing go down the stairs. She runs out of the room, takes a left, goes into our room. I'm following her, and I get to the banister, and I stop. For whatever reason, our bedroom door slams shut. I'm curled up against the banister. I'm looking down to see if these things are still downstairs. And the next thing I know, I'm not sure how much time would have passed at this point, but the next thing I remember, I'm out in our driveway, and I'm looking into the sky. And from where I'm standing, as if I looked up into the sky, I see these two white streaks go in through the sky, and it would be heading west to east, and then two more streaks that come by from south to north. And I remember that because it made like a tic-tac-toe in the sky. It stayed illuminated for a period of time. And as I start lowering my head out of the sky and looking towards the horizon by our horse barn, I see my brother just standing there. And if anything, I mean, if that wasn't odd enough, the most defined moment is the look in Tom's eyes were completely blank. He was just, he wasn't terrified. He was just blank. I could, you know, I remember the cool summer breeze coming through, and then I hear the door slam. My mother's running out. She's screaming for us. She grabs us both. We get into the house. We get into the kitchen area. Tom's kind of standing off to the back wall of the kitchen, just still blank, not saying a word. My mom's running around trying to, she gave us baby aspirin. I'm still not sure why she did that. And she was just frantic. And on the kitchen table was the old style Coke bottle caps. And I take my left hand and I take my pointer finger and I go to push the bottle cap as she's trying to communicate with Tom. And the bottle cap just flips up in the air and lands back on the table. And it startled me. So I asked, I said, Mom, look at this. And I did it again, and she witnessed it. All I did was touch the edge of the cap, and it would flip up in the air. She runs back to my brother, grabs him. She grabs me. We go into the living room and sat down. And to this day, I remember her saying these calming words, and she says, "Don't worry, they are gone." And we spent until the morning hours on the couch.
All right.
More than a version of that story. There's far more detail, but I understand.
Well, we took 11 minutes, and we got to open the phone lines. All right, caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name, and from where are you calling?
Yes, Kevin, this is Mike from Kentucky.
Hi, Mike.
Hey, what I want to know is, Thomas, I think it is, said that he was born club-footed?
That was Matthew, I think.
Which my brother, foot? Matthew.
Matthew, which foot?
It was my right foot.
Okay, I'm an investigator, been on it for over 50 years, and might let you know that I was also born club-footed in my right foot. And I'm left-handed. But
I'm left-handed as well.
Imagine that. Did any time during any of the memories that you have on the ship, on the table, did you see anything like you were on a table and there was like a buffet line passing by you on either side of you at the same time, almost like they were observing?
No, I had, in 69, I had one that was very close to me on the left side that at one point put his face up within probably 6 or 7 inches of mine. And I'll tell you this, in 99% of the time I've been around, it's always been, there's been someone on my left side. But this was the only time when I was on this table that there was one on the left, there was one on the right, and there was one at the bottom of the table. So, but that was three. And that room had more in them than any other. So I'd have to say that small room had maybe five or six of them in that room, but just the one on each side of the table, really, and one at the foot of it.
Okay, we're going to have to step away for break. Mike, you want to hang on through the break?
Of different types of alien.
Okay. Got to listen. We'll be back after this break. To the Kevin Smith Show. Mike, I believe you had a question you wanted to ask, and we'll have to do this quick, Mike, so we can get some other folks in before we run out of time. We have exactly 7 minutes left. What happened to Mike? Okay.
I have friends called Rosie and Charlie, and if so, tell her that Mike from Kentucky says hello.
Okay, Mike, I don't know what happened. I pushed the button and we got a dial tone, and then I got your voice. I don't know what happened.
Well, I think I know Debbie. In fact, her husband was in my house back in the 90s, so that's the reason I asked that question.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Mike. All right, folks, you're going to have to do it quick. If you want to call, the number is 623-444-5889. We have a flash message from Mark in Australia, and wants to know, do the orbs always precede the abductions?
Yes.
Okay. All right, to the telephone caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, this is Rex from Miami.
Hello, Rex.
Hi, I was curious. It sounds like Thomas has much more complete recall on board the ship than his brother. I was just curious if you guys had any idea why that might be.
Well, I can tell you this. We have a lot that we weren't able to get to, but my son has some very rare abilities that have been documented with hospitals and ESP type things and remote viewing, and he's my son, and I think what's happened, Matthew has some things going on with his children too, but I have a different blood type than my brother, and I'm wondering if maybe there was a more interest in my type. I mean, we all have Rh negative, we've got AB negative in our family, we've got A negative, and we've got O negative. I'm the only one that's O negative. My son is A negative, but for the most part, those are the three types, and we've wondered why that is ourselves. But I was a little bit older than my brother, and maybe I was at a certain age where maybe my makeup or what have you was just a little more of interest, and it carried through to my son. And it's really hard to say, but on my side of the family, there's more abilities that are being shown in some ways than Matthew's. Matthew's last child, though, is following suit with my son, with abilities and remarkable abilities with chess and numbers and math and remote viewing type of thing. So I just think it has to do with maybe the blood type itself. We're still working on it.
Okay. Yeah, interesting. Thanks.
All right, Rex, thanks for the call.
Okay.
We have time, folks, for one more real quick call. So if you've got your hands on the phone, I would be hitting the buttons now. 623-444-5889. Or in Canada, in the USA, we have a toll-free number, 888-223-4599. And, it's pretty interesting. The Rh negative seems to be, gentlemen, something that lots and lots and lots of people that have been abducted have the Rh negative blood type. What do you think is the reason for that?
You asking me, or?
It doesn't matter.
Oh, okay. We've got a feeling on that, too. We're looking into whether or not there's different chromosomes and different types of Rh negative factor as well. And my father was the only one who wasn't Rh negative, but he was also our stepfather. And he was the only one who had never had an experience. So in our family, the only ones who have were Rh negative. And then there were those that had more experiences that were a different type of Rh negative. And it definitely looks like O is the key. And then A negative, and then it kind of followed that. But then again, Matthew has had the latest and with the, you know, the physical evidence and the and so on. So who knows? We thought we had it figured out a little bit. We also know that it follows some suit with our children turning the age of six, and he had a child that was five at the time. So maybe that explains what happened in April. But there definitely is a correlation between our children turning a certain age and the children and the parent having a kind of a joint situation, if you will, or an experience.
It seems to run in your family as well. I mean, is your mom Rh negative and your grandmom?
Yeah, basically everybody in our family but my father.
Mm-hmm.
And my father, we weren't really able to talk about this because he was in politics. We were kind of urged to communicate amongst ourselves and keep it under wraps best we could, even though we
had broken this to MUFON in 1987.
Mm-hmm.
But he passed, and we've decided to talk about it now. But, you know, we're getting older, and he's not in politics anymore, and I just think it's time. And you know, we're also trying to get answers as well. I mean, just because it happened to us doesn't mean we know why. Really, we like to think we have a handle on it to some degree, but you certainly don't want to start overstating things and assuming you have the answers when you don't. So
that's a good policy.
You know, it's,
we have a flash message from Dale.
Shatter your sense of normal childhood, but we've made some nice friends along the way, just the same.
We have a flash message from Dale in the UK who wants to know, did you have more than one sinister experience? I guess he's referring to the one where you said they were pretty aggressive in 1969. Have you had more than one experience that was sort of sinister?
Well, that particular night was the only time that we recall it being that way. There are some visions and some pieces that you put together where you can remember some horrific moments. I do remember, you know, yelling, "Get away from me! Get away from me!" And that was, my heart was pounding, and it was part of that '69 situation. But I don't remember exactly when and where at that time when that took place. But until then, it was more of a befriending type of thing where, you know, it was almost like we were to be indoctrinated for something later on, and it was going to be an easy process, and that there was like a friendly type of thing, and it's really the way it came across, the passive. And then 69, it was just a totally different group, I guess, or it was all business. It was cold, they were distant, it was no compassion, it was just, you know, they had a job to do. And you know, you almost felt like you were going to be butchered. I mean, it was, you hear voices in the background. They don't sound like they're having a very good time. You're instead of being walked, you're almost being pulled down a hallway. And it was just definitely night and day from what we had experienced before that. Not that that wasn't, you know, surreal in itself. What this was.
Well, it, you know, what you're describing almost sounds like the initial meeting, and it's all wonderful. Is sort of a kind of a deceptive setup, isn't it?
Unless it was just a different group. I mean, this happened with my mother in 1954, where she had an experience, and Kim did in the same building, the same cottage, if you will. And then it happened with my brother and I, 66 and 67. And none of those were going to be labeled as barbaric or,
mm-hmm.
or, I mean, unpleasant maybe and different in its own way. But
So maybe it was just, as you say, just a different group. Tom and Matthew, I want to thank you for being with us. We are out of time. But if you will stay on the phone with me for just a moment. Ladies and gentlemen, there you have it. I wish we had more time to spend with these guys, and maybe we can convince them to come back and be with us again and get into a bit more detail about some other experiences. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time. So long, everybody.